This episode, Once Upon a Weirdness Magnet, Blue Devil, issue number 8. Hello, and welcome to the Once Upon a Geek podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On today's episode, we're finding our joy as we continue our coverage of one of my all-time favorite characters in comic book series, Blue Devil. Today, we're specifically covering Blue Devil issue number 8 from 1984. My name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but I'm not doing this alone, folks. I am once again joined by my own personal weirdness magnet, Mr. Diablo Frank. How you doing, buddy?
Nobody can explain the attraction, but I just won't go away.
You know what? I don't care if no one listens. It gives me a chance to chat with you, and that's what I really want to do, buddy.
Well, yeah, I mean, we literally have a line in our script saying chit-chat, and we've just chit-chatted for an hour straight, and none of you guys get to enjoy that, but also we're kind of sick of each other at this point. We're just going to have to try to knock this thing out as best we can in the aftermath of all the chitting and the chatting.
Are you kidding? I get to talk about Trickster robbing a bank in midair. I love this idea. I am so excited about this issue. This just brings me so much freaking joy. And it's drawn by Keith Giffen. So, I mean, come on, it's a complete win. So, this is the part of the show where I always brag that I am sitting here holding my bound, custom bound Blue Devil comics. So I've got open to issue number 8 with my cloth bookmark that's in there. And it's I'm very excited about looking at this.
I keep waiting on that fire and water magic to make rain and give me one like that. But so far, DC's leaving me high and dry.
You know, that's true. Like, brag's a harsh word, but it is a fact that a lot of things we podcast about materialize as collected editions from DC. I mean, a lot of people have mentioned it. Like you said, they joke about fire and water making it rain. And you're right. It hasn't happened for Blue Devil or Firestorm yet. What is the deal, people? We need to put that out in the ether, folks. We need a Blue Devil collection and we need it stat. So come on, DC, make it happen.
Well, especially because you're always talking up the digital versions that are on the app. So the work's been done. You just got to put it into print.
Exactly.
It's money on the table, guys.
Maybe if Swamp Thing had been more popular. Ian Ziegler? What was his name?
Oh, Ian Ziegler from Beverly Hills 90210. Yes.
Yes, that guy. All right. Well, folks, just as a reminder, I want to say this up front because I usually say it at the end, but we've had some people questioning why there was no image gallery for these shows. But if you want to see some images from these issues, check out the Once Upon a Geek social media. I'll be posting lots of images from these issues, especially ones we talk about leading up to this episode's release. So in fact, if you look in the show notes, there'll be a link directly to the posts that are specific to this issue. So there we go. Now, before we get too much further and Frank and I just talk about how much we hate each other even more, we should take a moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of Once Upon a Geek is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for comic book trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a comic book collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStock Trades library. And usually it's tied into our discussion in some way, shape, or form. As I mentioned, Keith Giffen draws this issue, so I picked a Keith Giffen book. And no, it's not the one you were expecting, folks. I picked Suicide Squad, Casualties of War. This comes from the 2001 series that he wrote. Suicide Squad was a 12-issue series, and that's all it was. And you can get the whole thing right here. And the storyline, it came out of Our Worlds at War, and don't let that scare you. But the storyline is that Sergeant Rock is now a general, and he is now leading the Suicide Squad. And before you get all bent out of shape about Sergeant Rock being in modern day, give it a read. Trust me, it's worth it. There's a payoff there that you'll be fine with. His team has got, you know, in addition to like the usual Deadshot, they've also got people like Killer Frost, Major Disaster, Reactron, Black Star. I mean, it's a lot of fun. It's drawn by Paco Medina, Joe Sanchez, and others. I really enjoy this series. I've revisited it a couple times. It makes me very happy. It normally retails for $29.99. You can get it for 40% off. So it's only $17.99, and I highly recommend it. I'm assuming you read this series.
Yeah, I'm one of the only other people on the internet that builds it up the way that you build it up. and I agree with normally people too. They World of War happened, and then everything about this series on a conceptual level sounds bad. You know, it's Sergeant Rock is sort of leading the team. You got very Umberto Ramos indebted manga style art, and this is not what the people from the 80s were looking forward to. But I gotta tell you, I really love that artwork, and it's very expressive, and you do have this weird, you know, a cognitive dissonance when you're watching these manga people get ripped to shreds. You know, it becomes a serial comic thing. And it's actually a really engaging story. And a lot of things that maybe bothered you at the time get resolved by the end of the series. And also, we've seen some really terrible Amanda Waller material over the recent years. So going back to this series and realizing they actually still knew how to write her back then, that's very nice. As a Firestorm fan, Killer Frost is so cool in this series.
Yes.
And that's a huge draw. Plus, she's foxy as heck, you know.
Yes, she is.
I'm not going to say hot because, again, Killer Frost.
Wah, but wah.
Yeah. What's really funny, too, is that when you mentioned this one, I was like, when did that come out? It came out a few years ago. I'm like, why didn't I buy that? I guess I must have been mad at DC that month, or I must have like been buying a bunch of omnibuses or something. I probably need to go to InStock Trades and get a copy of this sucker.
It's great. So it's like two parts, you know, Ostrander Suicide Squad. It's like two parts Keith Giffen's JLI, and then it's like four parts Keith Giffen is the best way to describe it. It's a lot of fun and well worth your time, folks. Now, what did you bring, sir, since we're talking about Keith Giffen?
Well, I wanted to represent Giffen art, and I kind of wanted to represent as close as I could this period of art, and there wasn't a lot available from our sponsor. So this is going to be Frank's not yet in stock pick. It's DC Universe by Keith Giffen hardcover. It's expected to be released on September 22nd, 2026. And the copy reads, "How do you define the life's work of one of the most imaginative and irreverent comics creators ever? We don't know either, but we're giving it a shot with this volume, collecting a plethora of Keith Giffen stories plucked from the pages of Legion of Substitute Heroes Special Number 1, Legion of Superheroes 1989 Number 1, Justice League America Number 45, Justice League Number 5, Secret Origins Number 34, Lobo Paramilitary Christmas Special Number 1, The Big Book of Urban Legends Number 1, Blue Beetle Number 1, 52 Number 17, Ambush Bug Number 1 through 4, and for the first time ever, The Heckler Number 1 through 6,
whoa,
restored in full color, featuring a foreword by J.M. DeMatteis. We hope this strange tome makes you laugh, cry, laugh some more, become confused, and be entertained by the one and only Keith Giffen."
Also, that is brilliant copy. In the spirit of Keith. That is amazing.
But it's also featuring work by Paul Levitz, Kevin Maguire, Simon Bisley, and more, including the wraparound Kevin Maguire cover in tribute to the centered Keith Giffen. The page count is 448. Retail price is $49.99. So in-stock trades will probably be around $29.99 based on Shag's estimates when he altered my copy without my knowing it.
Yep.
Coming soon, add to your wish list. So you can get this from in-stock trades. I myself have a copy on order, because I want a set of The Heckler, and I want the first Ambush Bug miniseries in full color, in glossy stock, not what I got from my Showcase Presents Ambush Bug. And this is probably the best chance I'm going to have of getting that material. And also, if we ever finish covering Blue Devil, I could easily segue into an Ambush Bug podcast as well.
Oh, wow. That's some dense material right there. I got to say, every single one of those comics that are listed are fantastic. Oh my gosh. Big Book of Urban Legends. I didn't think anybody but me remembered that. But wow, that looks fantastic. What an amazing collection. I'm so glad. I didn't even know this existed. I'm so glad you pointed this out. So DC Universe by Keith Giffen hardcover, folks. Get it. It comes out September 22nd. This looks fantastic. Great pick, Frank. Just fantastic.
I'll also note that I actually have quite a few of the big books still. I don't have a set, and they're really tough to put together, and they tend to cost you way too much money when you can find one. But what's also nice is I bought the Lobo collection of the first two miniseries, because that's most of the stuff I cared about. And the only thing that was really a glaring omission was the Paramilitary Christmas Special, which I'm going to get in the omnibus. So yes,
it's a win. It's and Heckler. That's crazy. So incredible. Well, folks, for these and all your other comic book trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Cause you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows, it really requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we need some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the shows on the network, the best way to support us is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. In certain tiers, you get mentioned on your favorite shows. This episode, special thanks go out to M.A. Sulco, Al the Comics Guy, David A. Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Mike Atchison, and some weirdo named Diablo Frank. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast.
I think I may already be on the record as having accidentally stiffed you on my Patreon payment when you came to Houston to visit AJ Wright and myself, but I also forgot to give you some sketches that I've been picking up for you as back podcast support. Hopefully I'll get them to you by Christmas. All I'll say is that one of them hits close to home, and some others would more likely get mentioned on a different Shagagaga podcast.
What you folks don't know at home is that Frank's already told me what the sketches are, so I'm ready to get in a car and drive to his house house right now to pick them up. They're that good. So it's very kind of you, Frank. So thank you very much. All right, folks. Now, remember, we need you to get out on the social media because this show is not just here to represent us and definitely not Frank, quite frankly. It is here to represent our entire geeky community and celebrate the things we love, including Blue Devil. So we want to hear your thoughts. Share your opinions on everybody's favorite weirdness magnet. Tell me how much you love a airborne bank robbery by Trickster and art by Keith Gibbon. We want to hear it. So first off, the best way to be part of the conversation is to leave a comment on our website, right? Just go to firewaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. Leave your thoughts there on the show post. You can also find us on Twitter and Blue Sky as Once Upon a Geek or on Facebook and Instagram as Once Upon a Geek Podcast. Now, as I mentioned, leave your thoughts on the website, the Fire and Water website, because we will read your feedback on the next Blue Devil issue. So like when we finish this discussion, Frank and I are actually going to cover your feedback from Blue Devil number 7. So get involved and be part of the conversation. So let's get into this. Blue Devil number 8, published by DC Comics, cover date January 1985, on the shelves October 18th, 1984. Cover price is 75 cents, 3 shiny quarters. That is, we are literally robbing DC Comics. 3 quarters for something this good? That's insane. Cover is by Paris Cullins and Gary Martin. Why don't you share the description, Frank?
Paris is in big cartoony mode as we see a cover covered in metal tendrils, which turns out to be cables carrying a mobile bank vault, which, barring an educational moment, I'm not aware of ever being a thing in the real world. Functionally, it looks like an elevator being carried above a small town by unknown means. The Trickster is trying to cut the cables with a giant pair of scissors while simultaneously kicking Blue Devil in the face. Dan is dangling from the edge, holding a cable in one hand and peeling off James Jesse's jester boot with the other. Cher looks on while herself dangling out of the door of the bank vault. Police in their cars are very tiny down below, which comparatively makes the big enchilada Mexican restaurant they're in front of look like a skyscraper. No one ever landing in the giant novelty sombrero on top of the building feels like a missed opportunity. Finally, I have to wonder if my description of the cover will end up running longer than the plot synopsis or just render it redundant, because not a lot else happens in this issue.
Oh, that's not fair. There's a lot of cool stuff in this issue. Ah, well, first off, all right, so this perspective is amazing. I mean, this is incredible layout. So yeah, you're a good, I don't know, 20, 30 feet above this mobile, like you said, it looks like an elevator, a mobile bank that's being moved. And so you're looking down at the Trickster as he's trying to cut with the ridiculously large shears. You're looking down at that. I love that part of it. And it's the ground is really clever how Paris did this. There's enough detail so that you can tell the height and the danger, but there's not enough to really distract from the drawing. So really your eye never really strays from Trickster and Blue Devil. And the positioning of the bodies is really, really well done. You know, Trickster leaning back, but he's kicking Danny in the face. Danny pulling off the booty. It looks brilliant. I cannot say enough good things about this cover. Did you like it, though? You gave a description, but did you like the cover?
Yeah, no, it's a cool cover. And what's nice, too, is since Paris is just focusing on the cover, we've had a lot of nitpicks. Like, we've liked the cover, but the background colors were too muddy. Or the background was too detailed, or the background wasn't detailed enough, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, we just don't have any problems with this. When everything on this cover works, the coloring works, the perspective works, the backgrounds are filled in well. It's one of his best covers in terms of just pure construction.
It tells a story, right? I mean, it's telling a full story right here on the cover. So that is, it almost makes me wonder, like, you know, Ed Hannigan was known for doing cover layouts back then, around probably a little earlier than this, actually. But Ed Hannigan used to do a lot of DC layouts, and then someone else would draw it. And it's such a brilliant layout that it just makes you wonder, like, what inspired him to think of this particular positions. It looks great. And that yellow background, yellow is not a color you see too often as a strong background color, but it works here because it makes all the blues and the reds and everything pop really, really well.
Well, and the yellow has a little bit of a gradient to it, which is nice because it helps to like center you on the action. Like you have a nice deep yellow in the periphery, and then it gets lighter as you go in, as almost like you're putting a spotlight on the characters. But I can't believe he did Paris dirty like that. I just don't see Hannigan constructing a cover like this. I think that quality that Paris has, that big cartoony quality, is uniquely his. I think this is all his. Now, obviously, Paris can chime in and let us know if we're wrong, or somebody else in the creative loop that you're friendly with that never has anything to say to me. But I think this is all Paris personally.
And I didn't mean to do Paris dirty. I mean, here's a little secret about podcasting, folks. A lot of times you start a sentence and you don't know where it's going to end when you're doing a podcast. And that's what happened to me there. I'm not trying to suggest that Paris wasn't the brains behind this. It's just that it occurred to me just that it's such such an amazing layout is where I'm really trying to go to, and I failed to really deliver that. Anyway, I like the shout out box at the top as well. This is it. Grand larceny in midair without a net, which is fun. And, you know, Sharon, like you said, she looks like she's about to fall out of the bank. And you make a good point. Like, I've never heard of a mobile bank before. That's what they're describing this building as, is a mobile bank. So I guess it's sort of like maybe one of those portables that you had in school. I don't know. I don't know what a mobile bank is, but that's what they're moving. They're moving a mobile bank by helicopter.
It's like a bookmobile, but with hard cash. What? What? But yeah, but again, you talk about podcasting. One of the magical things about podcasting is you absolutely want to do your partner dirty so you can put them on the spot so that they get stuck having to put that out on the internet.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. You know what? As a gift to you, I'm not even going to fix my nonsense in editing. I'm just going to let it live in the episode. At the end here, it's a genius layout. As you said, it's possibly Paris's best cover because it's so stinking fun. And this tells you right here on the cover, the spirit of Blue Devil, right? It's super heroics with a lot of zany fun, and it couldn't think more highly of it. All right, well, let's get inside here. So the writers are Gary Cohn and Dan Mishkin. Guest penciler is Keith Geffen. Whoop, whoop. Inker is Gary Martin. Letter is Todd Klein. The colorist is Michelle Wolfman. And the editor is Alan Gold. The issue is called Trick Trap. And here comes a recap for you, folks. Our story opens with Blue Devil and his girl Sharon and the supervillain Trickster cruising down the California coastal highway. Along the way, they spot a mobile bank that is being prepared to be airlifted by helicopter to a new location. Trickster immediately starts dreaming up a scheme of a mid-air bank robbery, but Blue Devil has other plans, pulling over for lunch instead. Even that doesn't stay quiet for long, because three kids try to steal Blue Devil's mystical trident out of the car, only to get blasted by magical energy. Then, Trickster discovers a chilling message hidden inside his hamburger. Somebody knows exactly who he is, where he's headed, and wants back whatever he stole. Terrified, he fakes a reaction to spicy food, bolts for the restroom, and smashes through the wall to escape. Now, convinced his only hope is money and distance from this mysterious organization, Trickster tracks down the flying bank. Armed only with black paint, he blinds the helicopter pilot, forcing an emergency landing. Blue Devil swoops in, tackling Trickster into the ocean, but Trickster slips free after handcuffing Blue Devil underwater. Meanwhile, Sharon boards the bank and distracts everyone with a sob story about saving her home, only to become trapped inside when the helicopter lifts off again. Elsewhere, the plot thickens at Santa Veronica College. We meet Professor Nebbish, who's being grilled over the murder of one of his graduate students who was caught with stolen Defense Department research documents. Afterward, Nebbish secretly contacts the assassin Bolt, and we learn that Bolt killed the student, and Nebbish coldly orders Bolt to eliminate the college chairman next. Now, back at the airborne bank, Trickster starts cutting the suspension cables with the acetylene torch he has hidden inside a rubber chicken, but stops when he hears Sharon's cries from inside. Blue Devil catches up just as the bank reaches the ground and reveals the punchline that there was never any cash aboard inside the bank. The money had already been moved by armored car. Blue Devil hauls the frustrated Trickster away, locking him in the trunk. Sharon departs with Blue Devil while Trickster begs to be released from the trunk. Then the next issue blurb, which is pretty funny, it's like a bulleted list, says, "The final showdown with Bolt. The secret of Trickster's pursuers. The art of earning cologne. There is no fourth item. Hey, kid, you gonna buy this book or what? This isn't a library, you know. Sorry about those last two items. Gary and Dan are probably sound asleep right now, and I'm just vamping to the end of the caption. Look, here it is now. Whew. Signed, Todd."
It's weird because I've said so many things about Todd Klein, one of the all-time greatest letterers in all of comics. Mm-hmm. And this was a fairly anonymous issue for him on the lettering front. So to have him literally name checked and writing out the end of the story is like, did you have to like save up all your energy for just the one panel? Is that what happened this issue?
Let's not sell him short. Obviously, I mean, yeah, there is no big lettering moments here, but you know, part of the job of the letterer is figuring out where to put the word balloons. That's part of the storytelling. And the storytelling here was flawless. And so you got to give the guy credit for that. Or maybe you don't. I don't know.
Yeah. So like, or do I? I just be silent and let you roll on.
Thank you so much for that. All right. So what'd you think of the issue, buddy?
I like the issue fine. It's one where, as I've mentioned, this was not one of the flea market books I got when I was collecting Blue Devil.
So this wasn't your first issue of Blue Devil this time, huh?
This time was not my first. As of now, it's my last for the moment anyway. And so I decided, well, you know, I've waited this long. I'm just going to wait till a few days before we do the recording. So it's very fresh in my mind. And I was, of course, picturing what Keith Giffen from this period would look like on Blue Devil. And it was weird because I was thinking it's going to be a lot like more gritty and moody and a lot more people with their entire faces blacked out. Mm-hmm. And like none of that stuff is here. Right. It's actually really nice and friendly. And I have to think that maybe Gary Martin had something to do with that. You know, it could have been Giffen just knew what the material was. But most of the time when he was doing guests on books, he just kept being Keith Giffen, doing Keith Giffen stuff. Here, it's keeping that bright, funny serial comic tone. And I have to think that maybe Gary Martin was just like, anytime he'd go too dark, was pulling him back and making sure that it stayed a Blue Devil book and protecting the brand.
It could have been. Or maybe, like you said, maybe Keith knew what he was getting into. Now, for me, I'm an easy mark for Keith Giffen. But even, like, for me, I don't know that his, and wait till I get to the end of this, I'm working on it. I don't know that his style is the best fit for Blue Devil. I mean, I enjoy this very much. And at this time, you know, he is known for drawing most of his characters a little ugly, you know, not as ugly as it would be by like, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but I mean, that's just how he drew people. They were not attractive. Now, as he gets towards the end of the 80s, it gets, you know, much darker, like the Legion 5YLs type stuff. But here, you know, it does sort of contrast against the way Paris Cullen's designed the characters. Now, with all that said, at the same time, his storytelling for this issue is absolute genius. I mean, I'm going to share a quote in just a second here about him, but the stuff he put, the way he lays this out, the ideas he's got in here, and some of this is his, make no mistake. So maybe for me, while it is sort of a clean lines, it's not the ideal type of Blue Devil art for me, but again, still absolutely amazing. And I got to share this story, then I'll let you talk because I know you're chomping at the bit here. So this is a quote from Back Issue Magazine, issue number 21, where they did an interview with Gary Cohn and Dan Mishkin. So this is Dan Mishkin talking. He's talking about issue Blue Devil number 8. He says, that was the issue that Keith Giffen drew and that many people tell me were their favorite issue. And Dan goes on to say, working with Keith was really interesting. When he got the plot, he called me up and said, hey, if I get from, and I'm making up pages here now, page 7 to page 13, a different way, take you where you start out and move in a long action sequence and come out where you want to be, does it matter to you how I do it? I checked with Gary and he said, no, that's fine. So Keith just drew this great action, funny sequence that we were able to put our dialogue to. There's a rubber chicken in it, which I don't think was in the original plot. It's terrific to work with an artist like that. So this isn't just an artist working from their script. He contributed, and some of the zaniness in here was down to Keith, and I think that's amazing.
Yeah, obviously Keith is known as a co-plotter on most of his projects, and I think that's one of the things he needs to stay engaged, to get through the books, because from very early on he was doing some stuff like, he's joked about how he'd get a script from Paul Levitz, he'd read it on the bus, wad it up, throw it into the rain gutter, and then go draw what he could remember from it. but he's such a brilliant storyteller, and he's one of my all-time favorite comic book artists. I had hoped to meet him at Terrificon during a road trip where I got to meet Dr. Ange, and he begged off of that appearance, unfortunately. And I was actually planning on going to a con that he was going to be at right before he passed away. Mm. So it's one of those instances where he was one of those old-timers that I wanted to meet so much. Yeah, I knew I wasn't going to get a piece of artwork out of him, but I wanted to at least try. And I didn't get that opportunity, unfortunately. But something about how he draws and how he storytells. Like, there are a lot of artists where, whether or not they have strong storytelling, I'm just bedazzled by the style. But Giffen's a guy who, there's just something about how he approaches storytelling that grabs me by the eyeballs. From as soon as I started seeing his work in comic books, I was compelled to start reading. Like, one of the first thing I bought that Giffen drew was Son of Ambush Bug number 2, which was not the entry point anyone should have for any creator, but there was just something inherent about his style that I just couldn't get past. I just love the way he tells stories. And again, we're 2 months out from the launch of the Legion of Superheroes, the Baxter series. We're 3 months away from, he's just finished up the first run on Legion, I should say. Okay. And then we're 3 months away from him starting Ambush Bug. And it's not the same month as the last Buggy strip in Action Comics. So this book should look different than it does. But it's just so bright and open and airy and nice. But he's also still got those Giffen chops, particularly those comedy chops. And again, it just grabs me. It's like I find this work irresistible.
Well, you know, I did a podcast all about the Justice League International for 8.5 years. And all of that was done with Keith Giffen breakdowns. And you really feel that same sort of essence here, because obviously he did the breakdowns here as well. You feel the comedic genius that's here, and it makes this story sing. And it's one of my favorite bonky concepts, or bonkers concepts, you know, robbing a bank in midair. And the way the story, you know, falls out, and the way the wackiness with Trickster happens, it's just genius. It's comedic genius.
Well, and Given's not known for precision, and yet I would say he's one of the better people at drawing Paris Cullen style horns the way you like them. And I'm sorry, but this is probably as pretty as I've ever seen Sharon.
Really? Okay. I mean, she's very pretty. There's no denying that. I think I like Paris's version a little bit better because I think he makes her a little more glamorous and a little more fun. A little more Suzanne Summers, probably. But she's very pretty here. Absolutely. Which is a huge contrast with a lot of the other women in this issue. You know what I'm saying?
We're going to get into that.
Okay. We're going to wait for that.
Put a pin in that one. What's weird to me, like, okay, so it's obviously a Giffen comic. And a Giffen comic isn't something I associate with Blue Devil. But it's nice that this isn't a Gil Kane situation where it's just like, this is good work, but I don't think it's the right venue for it. This is good work. And we could have easily had a Keith Giffen run on Blue Devil and I'd have been perfectly happy. I would never trade Ambush Bug for a Blue Devil run. But if he'd stayed on the book, honestly, I think you'd have been happier because I know you have a lot of trouble once the book hits the teens with some of the artwork. If it'd just been Giffen the entire time, I'd have been a happy camper.
Right there with you. Absolutely. His style would have worked very well for Blue Devil. Yeah.
And another thing is that you don't associate Zipatone with Keith Giffen. I just don't think he was willing to deal with the mess of that very often. So I have to figure that that's another instance of Gary Martin coming in and like giving that little extra pizzazz I'm not used to, because Zipatone is my love language. And this is not a place where I would expect to find it. But the Zipatone work here is pretty nice.
It looks great. Yeah, I was just noticing some of it myself. Like he uses it for shadows quite a bit. I guess I didn't really think about it until I read your note that Keith Giffen's not really known for doing Zipatone. Like he did a couple Justice League stories, and I don't remember him using it there, but again, I didn't really think about it either.
Well, I think if he was ever going to do it, it'd probably on Legion, though, right?
It would seem like it. Do
you remember any from like 5YL or anything?
No, everything was black.
Well, and he was also doing that kind of McGuire-y thing at that time, too, and that wouldn't have brought in Zipatone for that either.
Yeah, but he really definitely, I think he took a lot from McGuire's faces as he went into that Legion run, which, by the way, folks, just to make sure you guys know at home, 5YL is some of my favorite Legion work of all, actually, correction, is my favorite Legion work of all time, so absolutely love that story.
And for those of you who really don't know at home, 5YL stands for 5 years later.
Oh, yeah, I just kind of assume people know these things. All right, so let's talk about the story. We've talked a lot about Keith. So a couple things that I love in here. I love the whole buddy routine going between Dan and Jesse, James Jesse. That's a lot of fun. I love the opening with the coastal highway. They're driving down the road in the convertible, the caption box. They're like, talking about Sharon, the wind is whistling through her hair and his horns. Funny stuff really made me laugh. And it started off right on the right foot.
And that's one of those bits too, where you almost see Giffen maybe going in there and putting a little notation off to the side and then going ahead and fulfilling it. That gag feels Giffen-y.
Well, I mean, I don't want to sell. Let's see, now you're throwing Gary Cohn and Dan Mishkin under the bus by saying that the jokes aren't theirs, because there's some pretty funny guys. This book has been full of great gags.
No argument. But you know, we're stirring up controversy. We have to shake people out of their norms and get them talking.
See, Gary's going to send me a nasty note now. Thank you very much for that, Frank.
See, he doesn't send me nasty notes. So it being your problem means it's definitely not my problem. It's actually my pleasure.
Oh, you're the worst. A lot of foreshadowing this issue. You know, the Trident zaps those three kids unexpectedly, and Dan doesn't even know why the Trident zapped them. That's some foreshadowing for, I think, a story that'll pay off around issue 12. Then another one is Wayne Tarrant. You know, he's doing a toilet paper commercial, and there's some young women in that he meets up against, and he has forgotten who they are. That's continuing from a previous issue, so there's that subplot again. That resolves, I think, in issue 10. And then we've got foreshadowing some news story with Gopher tinkering around in Dan Cassidy's lab. I can't imagine what he's possibly doing. So we will find that out in a later issue as well.
Yeah, it's funny. It really, we had long gaps in covering Blue Devil. It has not been that long of a gap, but it's definitely been longer than one month after another.
Yeah.
And by this point, it's only been like 3 months or so, but I've completely forgotten why Blue Devil even needs to stick with the Trickster. And honestly, in this issue, I'm kind of with Sharon. It's like, cut this guy loose and just let Bolt sort him out. Or he could go running and crying to Barry Allen. He's in prison at this point? Maybe not. Okay.
He's on trial, certainly, at this point.
Certainly. For the longest trial in human history, yes.
Right.
But it's like you said, I would honestly, Trickster would be up for potentially my favorite supporting cast member in this series. And he's only in a handful of issues. But you're right. Just the banter between those two and the dynamics between those two. Not only is it great, and it's one of the reasons why I read the book, but it's also part of what defines the book for me. There's something about that particular dynamic of these goofy Silver Age villains and then Blue Devil being the new hip 80s guy who's, you know, kind of learning his way and stuff, bouncing off of those. those and things like, wait, we're in a comic book where they have mobile bank vaults. Well, probably not in 1980, but in 1960, in some Silver Age story, guarantee there's probably a mobile bank robber that they were borrowing from, right? So that contrast is really somewhat defining of the book for me. So I Trickster is a huge part of why I love Blue Devil, even though he doesn't appear that often.
Well, he's that sitcom trope of the character that you would never want to hang out with in real life, a character you can't trust, a character you know who's going to absolutely make the wrong decision, and yet you can't take your eyes off of them. You know, that's a sitcom trope. I'm totally blanking on any characters.
Well, one of my favorite sitcom characters of all time is Dan Fielding from Night Court. He's brilliant on that show, and he'd be a total sleaze, and you'd hate his guts in real life.
This is very much a Dan Fielding type of thing. That's part of what makes Trickster work so well. And actually, it makes me that much more sad that we didn't get to see the Gary Conan Dan Michigan Trickster miniseries that they kind of were thinking about. It would have been, and I think Ty Templeton was supposed to draw it, if I remember right. That would have been amazing. It would have been so good because they really had a handle on this version of the, or actually, I guess they kind of invented this version of the character, really, because prior to that, he was just a Silver Age bad guy. And here they gave him such an amazing personality and quirkiness and fun and the guy you love to hate kind of thing that it just works.
Well, and as far as I know, they were not doing the whole anti-hero thing or, you know, neutral, you know, ambiguous alignment in the Flash comics. So this very much informs what happens with him in Flash in the future.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. By the way, to answer your question, why they're hanging out together is last issue, he knew that Trickster knew Bolt was trying to kill him. And so he went to Dan Cassidy for help. So that's why they're together right now. That's what's going on here. And they're on the run. So when Trickster is eating his burger, and which, by the way, called a pinata, a burger, and there's a message inside, which is pretty funny. When he sees this note that says, "We know, you know, where you are, and we want back whatever you took from us," he freaks out. Now, the only thing I'll say is I don't know that that is ever resolved, because I'm pretty sure I remember who's looking for him. And we'll find out, I think, next issue. But like, how did they get the note in the burger in a random restaurant? Like, I don't think we ever revisit the restaurant, and I don't think those people are at the restaurant that are looking for him. So that struck me a little strange. Either way, I will be curious to see how that plays out.
Well, I will point out that the villain of the story arc can teleport, even though that would not necessarily be his MO, but it's possible. But also, we're dealing with a comic book with a mobile bank. I think maybe you're overthinking it.
Well, if I remember right, I don't think Bolt's the one who leaves the message. I think it's somebody else. But anyway.
Yeah, we don't get the impression of that, but we, A, are in a comic book where the villain can teleport.
Yes.
And it presumably did not create the teleportation technology because he doesn't seem like he's the type.
Yeah.
So maybe, for all we know, Dr. Nebish teleported in there, or one of his other students or something. But also, again, my dude, it's a comic book. Just let it go.
Fair enough. I do love Shut up. Let me talk.
Well, but you were literally talking about the scene, so I don't want to get too far from the scene. So, you know, the burrito gets splashed on Blue Devil.
Yeah.
And he's like, he splattered my alligator.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I would associate an alligator with any Mexican dish. And I really need that joke explained to me. And I don't think you're going to be able to pull that off.
No, I would just speculate it either had alligator meat or it was just, that's what they called that burrito. It was like what I would expect.
I mean, it's obviously one of those alternate dimension brands like Big Kahuna Burger or something, but applied to a random panel of Blue Devil, you're definitely left quizzical. So I'm with you in overthinking things, just different things.
It's fair. Okay. So are you done talking so I can talk about this joke, which won't be funny because now I've had to wait 10 minutes to talk about it. I love when Blue Devil calls Trickster, "You Ringling Brothers refugee." That is a great dig. And genuinely, I laughed out loud when I read that.
Well, the comedy is at the fore in this episode, this issue. And I got to be honest with you, while I was reading the issue, I was hearing my fan castings of Bill Hader, Kelly Cuoco, and especially Mikey Day as these characters were talking. So for me, it worked perfectly. But unfortunately, reading this issue, I realized that the guy I picked to do Bolt probably cannot pull off a Southern accent, which is what it seems like Bolt is speaking in during his cameo. So I probably blew that fan cast, but I think I nailed it with the other three.
Okay, fair enough. Let's see. I do have just some random art things I just want to mention. On page 4, there's just this really nice panel. And this is Giffen. This is Giffen's creativity, right? There's a great panel where Danny is thinking deeply. He's in deep thought and he's pulling on his Van Dyke goatee. It's just a nice little panel. They don't hang a lantern on it. It's just kind of there. And artistically, I'm like, oh, that's cool, because that's exactly what people would do. Now, on the next page, on page 5, and you got to tell me if I'm right or not, there is a panel of, I'm pretty sure that's Spike from Sugar and Spike. Am I imagining this?
I was actually writing that note because your notes were very scattered aired this episode. So I'm like, how could the co-star of the Fire and Water Podcast Network and the representative on this podcast for Rob Kelly miss a Spike reference? But yeah, that's 100% Spike from Sugar and Spike.
Yeah, he's even like, give her. So yeah, it's got to be totally.
And then I saw your note eventually. It's like, okay, delete, just like the Kite Man joke.
Well, the Kite Man, I love the Kite Man. Well, there's a guy flying a hang glider here, but his colors are absolutely Kite Man. So I got to imagine that probably wasn't a Giffen thing so much as the colorist was probably, you know, having fun there, making it look like Kite Man would be my expectation.
Yeah. And what that moment reminded me of when you did your skydiving a few birthdays ago. Imagining you in the same situation where you're like exhilarated and you're falling through the sky and your shoes going off and you've never felt this way in your whole life. And then some schmuck just ruining it by showing up out of nowhere and talking to you about where the nearest paint store was. Nice going, trickster. This dude is obviously fresh from a divorce. He's still thinking about the ex. He's like, but man, she would see me now. She never knew it would think I'd do something like this. I'm so happy. I'm above the earth. And then she just brings him right down to earth while being up in the sky. What a jerk this guy is.
So yeah, so he goes to a paint store, gets some black paint, literally paints black paint across the windshield of the helicopter so the guy can't see. And when the guy pokes his head around out the window so he can see, he hits him with black paint there, forcing the helicopter to come down. So literally, Trickster robbed a bank with black paint, which is pretty amazing. The whole, I said it before, but I don't care, I'll say it again. The whole plot of robbing a bank in midair is brilliant. It's genius. It's hilarious. I adore the premise of this issue. I love at the end when they reveal that the bank never had any money at all anyway, because they're all being transported by armored car. Blue Devil's like, do you really think they would have had the money in there? And Trickster's like, very sadly, goes, they would have in Central City, which is just, it's like, it finds a way to be a nice dig at the Flash comics anyway. I adore that. So good.
The one disappointment I had, though, well, two. One is that he gets to paint, and I'm totally thinking he's going to do a Wile E. Coyote thing, like painting against a mountainside, and the helicopter crashes, something along those lines. So when it's just a matter of smearing black paint on the window, he's like, that felt like a wasted opportunity. And then, of course, he actually paints the pilot, so he has literal blackface. And it reminded me a few issues earlier in Action Comics, they did an Ambush Bug, where Buggy gets fried, electrified, and he's turned solid black, like the black suit Spider-Man, and then he kind of leans into it in a way that would get him canceled today. So I kept like spinning off any of these other jokes that weren't in the comic book, unfortunately.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, why didn't they do that joke? I wanted this joke. So that's just me being, you know, a party pooper on that front. But since you mentioned the colorist contributing, I'll also point out that I did like that apparently Blue Devil can blush, because there was that one sequence where Sharon's talking to him and he becomes a purple devil. And at first I thought it was bad coloring or bad printing, I should say. And it turns out, no, wait, Sharon just set him up. He's blushing. He blushes purple. That's a nice touch.
Yeah, she says, you're my hero, Danny. Aw, I didn't even notice that. So that's really good. Good catch. By the way, you spend like 10 minutes complaining about Keith Giffen didn't draw like Keith Giffen with not people faces all in black. And when you finally get the guy with black all over his face, you don't cheer it. What's wrong with you? All right. So there are some funny little Easter eggs hidden in here. And I don't know whether these were Keith or whether they were, well, I know for a fact some of them was Gary Martin. Like there's on page 7, there's this woman, which we still got to talk about, who's holding a clipboard, and I couldn't read it in the comic. I actually had to get the digital version on DC Infinite and zoom in and zoom in and zoom in. And on her clipboard, she has a little sticky note that says, inkers are underpaid, which is brilliant. Then on the next page, when Gopher goes to Danny's workshop, there's all these notes all over inside the workshop that say things like, get the lead out, signed by AG, which is Alan Gold, the editor. Or it says, you're late, signed by Alan. And so those are a lot of fun. And then there's other books in there too. There's like a Bernie Wrightson book, an Art of Star Wars book, and he put a Pogo little drawing in the background, which was used to be Paris Cohen's hallmark on this book, throwing a Pogo in every issue. So that was nice.
There's alien references in this book, which is definitely in my lane. There's two Jaws gags in this book, including turning Blue Devil into the movie poster, which was cute. What I'm wondering though is this a special effects guy? So why am I not seeing a copy of Grand Illusions by Tom Savini or Ray Harryhausen's Fantasy Scrapbook or anything that actually fits his field?
There is actually a Harryhausen book in there. I couldn't see it until I looked on the digital version and zoomed in. But in that panel, there's a bookcase full of books. And hang on, I'm zooming in now. The one has Bernie Wrightson, one says Art of Star Wars, and one says Harryhausen. So they do have a Harryhausen in there.
Nice. See, my copy, I think I got for a buck at a sale. So, and my old eyes can't handle this newsprint to that degree. So I'm glad you had the digital copy to zoom in on.
Yeah, there's no way I'd be able to. I can't read it either in the physical copy. So thank goodness for digital. digital, right? By the way, on page 12, there's this great billboard as well that you can only see like half of. So you can't actually read the full billboard. You have to do a lot of interpretation. Again, but it says like, absolutely no. And again, figuring out what it says. Absolutely no swimming, diving, loud music. I'm not sure what the next thing is. Maybe, I don't know, forethought, afterwards, or superhero battles, signed by P. Namor, as in Prince Namor. I love those kind of little Easter eggs. They're so cute. Now, let's talk about the way certain people, I mentioned people are not drawn very pretty in this issue. Like some people are drawn straight up ugly. And you had some comments on this, right?
So I have to wonder if maybe GIF has hangups over freckled girls with squished faces and exposed shoulders. Because there's a lot of that in this comics from this time period. I definitely saw it in the Ambush Bug miniseries. I'm thinking of Ambush Bug especially. I think it turned up in like one of his Justice fill-ins, probably in Video Jack. I think it's just a thing for him, and you know, let the man have it. And I'll be honest with you, I'm kind of into it too. But it's just kind of it's an atypical presentation of an interest in women. But I respect that he's got variety in his taste.
Well, he's drawing the woman. She's got a cigarette dangling out of her mouth. She's got the short kind of cropped haircut. She is not what you would see as a typical glamorous woman. In fact, she's actually having a conversation with a very attractive, cute girl as well. So it's very purposeful that he's drawing her this way. And sort of like you said, I remember this look from Ambush Bug. And you know, it's weird. I think Son of Ambush Bug was my first Keith Giffen as well, probably. And probably my first Ambush Bug. But I remember a lot of characters looking like this. And he's drawing, the best that I could probably describe him is regular people, you know, rather than the comic book illusion of everyone's beautiful. He's drawing people that, you know, are probably normal looking and not necessarily super glamorous.
He's so great at that. And I know some of that is the Jose Munoz influence that he picked up in that time period, because Munoz also did that. But Giffen gives it like a gloss to where it's richer and inkier and comic bookier. And he just has a greater variety of people, different faces, different body types. I love that variety. His cities feel so legitimately populated. He's so good at doing urban settings because there you can tell this guy is not related to this guy. It's not one of those deals like, the fellow who drew Preacher, where every single person in the book has the same face as him.
Oh, you know? Be nice, like, to Steve Dillon.
Steve Dillon, yes. But the mirror was doing a lot of work when he was drawing those books, where Keith is like, seems like he's looking at his environment, because there's just all kinds of different people. I love his ability to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, weirdly, large numbers of people who have no chin, squish noses, beady eyes, like definitely not idealized people at all.
Well, that's what people look like in real life. That's what I'm saying. So, you know, speaking of Keith, let's talk about this thing that Dan Mishkin said about Keith drew a whole sequence on his own. Like he said, if I get you from point A to point B, is that okay? How I do, you know, how I do it, whatever I want. So I would say it's definitely pages 19, 20, and 21, because Dan did specifically say there's a rubber chicken in there. And I absolutely love that. So Trickster has an acetylene torch hidden inside a rubber chicken, which is just genius. I absolutely love that. Anyway, so, I got to think it's pages 19, 20, and 21. And I wonder if it's also the earlier fight in the water. I wonder if Giffen did that kind of on his own as well. You know, pages like 12, 13, 14. I wonder if that was all him.
I absolutely think so. And it's one of those things that lets you know that there's no one rule on how to do comics. Because I know there are some people, John Romita Jr. comes to mind, who really wants everything in the script. He wants you to tell him exactly what you want to draw, and he's going to draw the thing that you told him to draw. A lot of artists, if you like dictate, okay, in this panel there's a roundhouse, and in this panel we shift to a worm's eye view, it just crushes their drive. It makes them feel like they're just doing, you know, exactly what they're being told, and it crushes their spirit. You look at somebody like George Perez, who loves these gigantic crowd scenes full of hundreds of characters. But my understanding is one of the delays on Legion of Three Worlds, when he was doing that with Geoff Johns, is Geoff Johns would put in the script the 15 different people he wanted in this panel, and it just took all the fun out of it for George. And obviously George would almost always do that on his own, but because you told him to do it and dictated how to do it, he just didn't want to draw it. It killed his enthusiasm. Yeah. A lot of artists feel like action is what they're supposed to do, and it's where they get to have their fun, and it's where they get to make their contributions. And obviously they're better at being visual storytellers than some writer typically. And so just let them have that fun. Let them go off and do that. And obviously these were wonderful results because, as was mentioned, this is some people's favorite issue.
Yeah. And I can see why. I haven't sung enough praises of the robbing of the bank and everything else. So it's I could totally see why this would be people's favorite issues.
Yeah. Even though I don't understand why you'd be using the blowtorch rubber chicken on the cables, because I don't understand how the trickster is going to move the cash once he's crashed the bank, especially because he already has a helicopter that he could just commandeer and fly it to someplace to rob it. But it's still a great visual, and I'm loving that Giffen came up with that. And I've never not associated with the trickster with rubber chickens as a result of this.
Right, exactly.
And I didn't even read this issue, so I'm imagining it must have come up in another issue, but I just make that association.
Well, stuffing an acetylene torch and rubber chicken is definitely a crazy thing. I got to assume his idea is to cut loose the bank, because in theory, there's not supposed to be anybody in the bank, even though there is. Cut loose the bank, let it crash to the ground, which will probably crack open the vault, which will give him the money. I imagine that was what his plan was. And Eastern Central City, they don't care about, you know, getaway cars. They just grab what they can and run. So that's all I can imagine.
He needs one of those bags that like can take infinite amount of money in it or something, because he's not even like dressing in clothing that really would allow for a lot of stuff. I'm sure all of his pockets are already filled with rubber chickens and smoke bombs and stuff. So where would he even put a single wad of cash?
Well, if there's any character that's going to have like a bag of holding, Trickster seems like the guy, like a clown car. I do like that here that he stops cutting the cables once he realizes Sharon is inside there. So he's showing that he's sort of part of the team that they've sort of built here of Dan, Sharon, and Trickster. So I like that he's playing by their rules. So that's very nice. Also, I like that they gave Sharon something to do in this comic. They gave her something to do that was specifically tied to her career. She goes in and she acts. She pretends to be this, you know, single mom whose house is about to be foreclosed on if she doesn't get her money in the bank. And so they gave her actually something to do. And then, of course, made her, you know, a bit of a damsel in distress. But I like that they gave Sharon something to do other than just drive the car.
But what exactly was she accomplishing when she did that? That's the one thing. It's like, but why though? What did this do? What besides keep her in the frame and give you an opportunity to make the trickster sympathetic when he's being a big jerk and not staying with the right play? I see what she accomplished in the story, but like in the action within the story, I'm not sure what that was supposed to be accomplishing.
Okay, well, what she was doing was the bank lands and she runs over there and she realizes that they're going to call the police because of Trickster, and she doesn't want Trickster to get in trouble, which frankly he should be arrested, but anyway, she doesn't want Trickster to get arrested, so she wants to go in there and distract them so that they don't call the cops, so that Danny can actually get Trickster out of there rather than the cops. That's actually why she does it.
Or let him get arrested and they can carry on with their trip and she can enjoy her date. Her motivation's maybe a little bit off, but that's the actress in her, I guess.
But Danny wants the Trickster. She even offers him an out. She says, well, you know, we could lose the Trickster and just go you and me. Danny was obsessed with taking care of the Trickster. So she's trying to do right by what her man wants.
And that's another thing that's cool about the issue is that they make reference to the first meeting between Blue Devil and Trickster, where he's kind of fumbling because the suit isn't made to fight bad guys. The suit's made to perform actions in a movie. But he's pointing out that, you know, he takes Alan the Trickster pretty well this time because he literally says the line, I've had a lot of practice since then. And also, I remember his halting, you know, unwilling heroism from the early issues where literally his whole neighborhood's getting knocked down by shockwave. And he's like, wait, why is this my problem? And now he's making Trickster's, you know, life his problem. So he's gotten better at heroing and he's also becoming a hero despite denying it in the past just by repetition. It's almost like muscle memory. This point was like he knows how to hero now because he's been heroing for the last 8 months and it's in his blood at this point.
Yeah, the DC Heroes role-playing game came out about this time and they introduced something called motivation, and he is the definition of reluctant hero. He really it's the perfect motivation. It explains him so much because at this point he is reluctant, but he's doing it anyway. And that panel where he says that he's got more practice, I love that he's doing a flyby holding the trident in kind of a weird, you know, athletic position or acrobatic position. And he yoink grabs Trickster by the cape and starts dragging him. And Trickster was so not prepared for that. So it looks fantastic. Great. Another fantastic art piece by Giffen.
One thing that's cool with Giffen too is he's got that big Tex Avery influence. And again, that's where a lot of this comedy comes from, is the visual comedy learned from Looney Tunes. And something like when Trickster busts out of the restaurant, he's got all these tricks. There's all these ways he could have just gotten out of the restaurant. People would get out of restaurants through back doors all the time. The fact that he had to blow that gigantic hole in the wall because comics. But yeah, you want to see the big hole and you want to see the look on Dan's face when he sees the hole. You know, the logic doesn't matter. The effect was rendered.
It looks great. And I hadn't thought about the sort of Wile E. Coyote style of it. You're right. And Tex Avery, it is totally that sort of style. And that's exactly who Trickster is. Yeah. Good point.
And of course, being storytellers, master storytellers, the art of the game is in figuring out how to work these subplots. And Giffen serves that. I love that you had that Freudian slip where you called him Dr. Nebbish, where I think it's Nemish, but he clearly is meant to be a Nebbish. So I don't know if that was an intentional thing or if it's just you reading into it, but I love that little line that he threw out there, turning him into the Nebbish. Mr. Nebbish.
That's totally me mispronouncing it. Yeah, no, it's Nemish or Nemish. Yeah, absolutely. And this is a strange subplot here. Like, he's in charge of Bolt. Bolt is doing his bidding. And like, it's funny, like, I don't remember this subplot at all. Like, I've read these issues a lot over the years and I'm like, who is this guy? What? Huh? So I'm very interested to see where this plays out. Obviously, he must come back at some point since he's in charge of Bolt. But there we go.
Well, and it's one of these situations where because Bolt and Trickster loom so large in my memory, I have to assume that I've read the next issue, but I'm not 100% certain. I can't recall it off the top of my head. So I may have never, you know, found that out. I might have just drawn all of my awareness of those two characters in this context from the one Gil Kane issue. I'm not sure. I'm looking forward to finding that out the next time we record.
These pages almost feel a little bit of prototype Giffen for what's to come, because like the first page, I'm talking about pages 17 and 18. 17 has 9 panels now, and it's in a grid format, except the panels vary. Like, you've got a skinny panel, a medium-sized panel, and a I don't know, moderate-sized panel. So each of the panels keep varying in size, but and the next one's 10 panels, but it sort of feels like it's almost a 9-panel grid, if you see what I'm talking about.
I honestly think that maybe it was just Giffen adhering to the style of Blue Devil, because by this point, he was pretty married to the 9-panel grid. Which I also adore, by the way, probably because of Giffen. Yep. He was already doing 9-panel grids in the Action Comics strip. He's going to do it throughout all the Ambush Bug stories. Obviously, not every single page is rigidly 9 panels, but that's the basic structure from page to page. But clearly, he's not remotely doing that here. He's doing more of a Perez thing, where he's given each panel the space it needs. And because this is a much more action-oriented book, then you've got to open it up some. So it might have just been he looked at what Perez was doing and gave it some of that rhythm.
Could be. The only other thing I have to say in here is I was really looking forward to talking about this ad in here for NBC's Saturday morning lineup, because I was like, oh, we talked about cartoons last time. So I was all ready to talk about how much I love Kid Video. And you reminded me that we had this exact same ad last month. So NBC actually paid for the same 2-page ad in their comics 2 months in a row, which is very strange.
Well, it might have been one of those situations. I didn't check the release dates. Maybe you had 2 issues in the same long month, and that's why it ran twice.
I don't know.
They didn't rerun the CBS one with Pryor's Place and stuff, because those were my you know, Richard Pryor was the thing I stuck with on that one. Kid Video, because I like Kid Video. That's why I remember that we had done this one already, because I got excited too. It's like, great, we're going to talk about another one. It's like, oh, wait, we talked about Kid Video specifically. But the CBS one did not repeat this time. So I guess NBC just were big money. You know, they wanted to really get their Saturday morning cartoons in front of people.
It's weird because like the ad itself says their Saturday morning lineup starts on September 15th, but this comic was on the shelves October 18th, an entire month later. So either way, maybe they had that much confidence in going bananas. Maybe that's what it was.
So. Sorely misplaced. That was the super train of the Saturday morning set. But yeah, it does make you want to kind of look around and try to dig up that year's ABC ad if there was one. Maybe ABC just didn't have the money that year. But man, I want to talk about the ABC lineup. This is part of the fun of this show.
Back before this podcast existed, I used to blog and I had actually a blog, Once Upon a Geek. It's still out there. onceuponageek.com. You can visit it. And I did put a whole bunch of Saturday morning ads from comics on there as just one of the things I was celebrating on there. So I'm sure I have it out there somewhere, but
Saturday morning fever.
Greatest theme song we ever got Luke to do for us. I love it.
And like 3 episodes.
You're very partial to your Secret Files one, obviously, but that Saturday morning is just amazing.
Oh, I absolutely love that. And it would definitely play it into my asking him to do the theme, but that and of all things, son of a lighthouse keeper always stuck with me.
Oh, makes me cry, man.
It's legitimately a sad, like, Gordon Lightfoot kind of number.
Jeez. I mean, like, I was thinking about that not that long ago and started crying. It's just so powerful. So, in summation, I mean, I freaking love this issue. We've celebrated Keith Giffen's amazing layouts and art in this thing. We've celebrated, at least I have, the insane idea of robbing a bank in the air. We've celebrated the way they've given us this great, you know, as you said, Dan Fielding type of sitcom character who you love to hate. And this issue is such a joy. It just makes me so happy. And any closing thoughts on the issue from you?
I just have to say that I went into this issue not wanting to be like, this was just a filler. We didn't really need this, you know, because I don't want to be negative Nelly. The show is about positivity and finding our joy and such. But I have to say, honestly, you took me by the hand. You guided me through what all was accomplished in terms of the character dynamics and, you know, evolving the relationships of those characters, evolving the story, things that I had missed. So ultimately, I have to be, you know, I was already favorable because of the Giffen artwork and Gary Martin's inks and everything else. But I have to say, you also showed me the light in the quality of the storytelling as well.
Woohoo! Frank, everyone mark your calendar. Frank actually listened to me for once.
Well, every now and again, I had to stop talking and take a breath.
That's true. Man, you were killing me there. All right. So moving ahead here, before we do the awards, we should mention the letters page, Speak of the Devil here. They have got a couple different things I just want to mention. First off, they promise in here that Mike Chen is going to be the new regular artist on Blue Devil beginning with issue 11. Sorry, folks. That will not be the case. That does not happen.
So when Siskoid was doing, well, I mean, he's threatening to bring it back. There's been some teases of it, but he had his Who's Editing podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And even more so than usual, I lost my mind. And instead of doing manifestos, being the Unabomber of comics that I am, I was doing like fanficky type stuff in his comments.
Right.
And to fuel that fan fiction, I was reading a lot of material from the time period of Who's Who. And of course, Who's Who is rife with Atari Force entries. And I'd always meant to read Atari Force. There's one, not a podcaster, but a blogger and social media person I like that just absolutely adores Atari Force. To him, Atari Force is like the way Dread Star was to me. And so I always felt like I needed to read that series, especially because of those gorgeous Jose Luis Garcia Lopez drawn
Who's
Who pages. Yes, praise be his name. And so while I was going through that material, they had a run of backups. And of course, Keith Giffen did a number of hookah backups, which he then exploited for, you know, fodder for satire and Ambush Bug after the book was canceled. And a few months after his hookah backups, Mike Chen did a run of three issues for Pack Rat, you know, fairly obscure character. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I have to credit him or if I need to credit the inker on those stories. But like when I was looking, Joe Del Bieto, who's probably a Jose Del Bieto based on the last name, but he's credited as Joe Del Bieto. So when I'm looking at this, I'm like, who is this guy doing Pack Rat? Because the artwork reminded me of early Art Adams. Mm-hmm. The inking style was very reminiscent of peak Terry Austin.
Ooh.
And it was just like packed with detail. And it's a Pack Rat backup from late in the Atari Force run. What is going on here? So I had to research Michael Chen to find out who this dude is. He really honestly didn't have much of a career. He's got like about a page on the Grand Comics database. And I've looked at some of his other artwork and it's fairly indistinguished. He actually does come back to do Blue Devil, or for an issue of Blue Devil, I should say, but he's actually doing the Mask mini comic that's in the middle of a Blue Devil. He drew that. But for this three issue arc, it was just fantastic artwork. And the run starts in March, the March issues, and we're looking at the January. So like 2 months later, he's doing that arc on Pack Rat. Surely that played into, you know, his being selected as Blue Devil artist. While not looking anything like Paris Cullens, he's extremely similar to Cullens in the packing in of details and like really looking like going to be DC's vanguard of DC in the 80s. There's no stopping us now, unless the people don't produce artwork. And that's what Michael Chen did. Is he just didn't get much of anything else out there and he wasn't able to keep up the quality of Pack Rat. But God, if he had drawn Blue Devil, that we would have had our collection, I think.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'll have to go look. I mean, I remember the hookup backups. I'll have to look at some other stuff that he's done too, because I certainly know the name and I'm sure I've seen some stuff from him. It's just not coming to my mind right now.
He had a run on Warlord, a very brief run. And I think he did some inking as well, because he was not productive with the pencils. So he did some inking and then he just sort of faded out of the industry eventually.
Also on the letters page, you've got a letter from Michael Urie, which is great. Future editor of Who's Who and head honcho at Tomorrow's Publishing. So that's really cool. And a super nice guy too. Then two other things to mention. There is some house ads in the back here for America versus the Justice Society. And then Johnny Thunder, aka Thunderbolt. But more importantly, there is a full page editorial here. The Meanwhile column by Dick Giordano. You guys may remember those. It is one long scathing piece about Justice League of America versus the Avengers. And the article is called The Death of a Dream, where Dick Giordano squarely places the fault of the JLA Avengers series that never happened on the feet of Marvel, and defending themselves against Marvel's, I guess, scathing piece against DC and Marvel Age.
Yeah, so you're the reason why I stayed up till 4 o'clock in the morning that night, because I was trying to finish up my notes, and I see that it's like, okay, we're going to definitely talk about that. And unfortunately, it was Death of a Dream Part 2.
Yes,
and that's true. Part 1 was not in the previous issue of Blue Devil, so thankfully it was in one of those Atari Forces that I was looking through to find the Pack Rat story.
Oh my gosh.
So, and then, of course, after having read that, I had to go back to the original Marvel Age. I didn't have the resources to look at all the fanzines that were being referenced in Marvel Age, but this was a whole thing. This was like name withheld in the early 90s in Comics Buyer's Guide, where it was like this sprawling mess across various publications, right? So I did read up on this stuff.
There is some pissed off people. I just read this Meanwhile column. Now, I had always heard certainly stories of who blames who for the death of JLA versus the Avengers, but I mean, there's some serious angry people here is what this is.
Well, what I thought was funny, Giordano makes a point of saying, it's funny, the article in Marvel Age, this is the only one that doesn't have a byline. You know, I don't know who wrote this, but the implication is strong that Jim Shooter himself wrote this. And I thought it was interesting because of all the people, you know, if somebody's not going to get copy edited, it's the editor-in-chief. And he managed to use the word Machiavellian and misspell it in Marvel Age. So he'd be the only one who could get away with that under Jim Shooter's reign. So I'm pretty confident Shooter's the one who wrote this himself. And I think what it was is you had all these talent talking out about him across a multitude of publications, and he felt the need to personally answer that in Marvel Age, and who but Jim Shooter would be able to get that particular axe ground in one of their major solicitation, you know, materials where it's press copy that they force the fans to pay for, so they don't just let any old thing in Marvel Age, and the people who edited it would not just let any old thing, but you let this multi-page screed about how everybody's going after poor Jim, and he just wanted to make sure there was the best possible story and yada, yada, yada. He absolutely wrote that. And Giordano knew it and was pegging him for it in the meanwhile. And again, if you read the meanwhile, he says, look, it was my fault. We pushed forward without all the ducks being lined up, and we got Prez doing art while we had him available. And, you know, we not had approval for that yet. And that's my fault. And I'm sorry for that. And again, if you read between the lines, what I hear as a working man is that this one guy was being petty and nitpicking, and we are on a time schedule. I'm going to take my editorial cues from the need to get this thing out and have it drawn by George Perez to get started on this. And anything we need to fix, we can fix later on. We'll paste in a panel. We'll write some dialogue to cover it up. But Shooter was possibly just being Shooter, because he's been known to be super nitpicky about other people's stuff, and then his own work sometimes is not up to his own standards. And then that gets pointed out, the hypocrisy of that. But I you know, Giordano saying that he's nitpicking it because he just wants to kill the project. I don't think that that's necessarily the case either. I just think that he was such a fanboy and also such a marked net that he was going to drive everyone insane and destroy the deadline if it wasn't going to be done his way. And I do think probably a part of it was that he wanted to exert his power and his dominance. And so it wasn't necessarily that he wanted to kill the book, but he was going to kill the book because he was suffocating it through his shooterness. But yeah, I totally get that. And everybody has said that. Everybody has agreed that, yeah, maybe Dick was wrong to get the pages started, but at least those pages exist. And the book doesn't exist, and it's because of Jim Shooter. And, you know, I'm a Shooter stan. Like, his run at Marvel is one of the greatest editor-in-chief runs of all time. Some of my favorite comics ever produced were produced that period. Sometimes specifically because of his involvement, like the Dark Phoenix saga would probably compare to Footnote if he hadn't insisted on the change to that weak ending that they were going to go with, as for
right,
instance.
Right.
And even as a writer, I think he's done some really great work. I, you know, he was doing Moore-ish work in the same time period as Alan Moore, is one of those things kind of like with Mark Gruenwald, where Gruenwald was sort of doing the first pass at things that Moore got famous for later on. Shooter did a little bit of that too, but also there were a lot of things where he was clearly influenced by Moore, but it was to the good, and he wrote some really good stories. And I very much enjoy him as a writer. I even liked his last Legion run, which a lot of people didn't like. But and I met the man. He was a great guy to talk to and stuff. But at the end of the day, he still is who he is. He was the prodigy of Mort Weisinger, and you don't just scrub that off. You know, you don't just wash that off in the shower. That was just part of who he was. That's part of the controversy and the polarizing nature of the man. So I, you know, Dick Giordano has his issues with truthiness as well. But anytime you have a he said, he said that involves Jim Shooter, always bet on the other guy. You know, just. Everybody knows this. There are way more people saying one side of the story than the other side. And I think that because Shooter felt the need to put it into the press, that Giordano was 100% his rights to answer that. I think it was necessary to answer that because at that point it was propaganda, and DC had to fight against that because Shooter was trying to put all the blame on DC, and clearly that was not the case.
So we've gone way off the reservation, but I will share one quick Jim Shooter story, and then we got to move on. I also met him at a, I can't remember if it was Heroes Con or Baltimore. Very nice man, incredibly nice man. Had a great little chat with him, and I was talking with another creator later about it and how nice he was. I'm like, you know, you always hear these stories about da 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 da, and they're like, oh, those stories are true. And they said, why do you think that Jim Shooter is over on that side of the hall, and all of the other comic creators are on the opposite side of the hall? That's not an accident. I'm like, oh my gosh. So, all right, let's put this to bed. Let's move on. Overall, the issue. So now we need to nominate the Weirdness Magnet Award. This is where we're going to nominate our favorite moment from this issue, Blue Devil, whether it's a story beat, something in the art, something that's made us laugh, whatever. Frank, you're up first. What is your nomination for the Weirdness Magnet?
Well, you decided to keep it a secret, so I don't know what yours is going to be, but for me, it's Jesse No Socks. The image of him having his jester boots taken off, and it's just his little pinky toes, you know, waving in the air with nothing else covering them, and he's got the little strap on his little ballerina tights or whatever it is that he's wearing. That just amused me too much. And it's the sort of thing where you don't think about what characters are or are not wearing with relation to the costumes. And just to have that pointed out, it's like, oh, wow, he runs around with no socks. That's probably kind of messy. That's probably pretty nasty. But it was funny image, and so that was my Weirdness Magnet nomination.
Yeah, he's basically what they're wearing, what they would call now stretch pants, and they're funny. It's orange striped stretch pants at that. Mine is actually the combination of those three pages, because it includes your funny page. It's the stuff that Giffen did, right? That Dan Mishkin said that, you know, they Giffen knew point A and he knew point Z, and he was allowed to fill it in however he wanted in the middle. And it's Trickster flying upside down, Danny slipping out a banana peel, you know, the acetylene torch inside the rubber chicken, the pulling the booties off, the grabbing Trickster by his cape and spinning him up like a top. I just love those three pages together. It's a great sequence, and Giffen poured a lot of creativity into it, and I love it. So congratulations to both of those moments. You have won a Weirdness Magnet Award. It's well-deserved. Please wear it with pride. Now, folks, we hope you enjoyed this comic as much as we did. We had a lot of fun with it. But right now, we are going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we are going to cover your feedback from the last episode.
I was 24 when we first created Captain America. Jack Kirby was 22.
There wasn't a day passed by that we didn't get news from Europe in the newspapers. Everybody was patriotic, and it was ridiculous not to do Captain America.
I would have been proud to have said, Jack and I did the Fantastic Four and let it go with that, but my gosh, at the same time, we were doing Thor, the X-Men, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
I went to the Bible. I came up with Galactus. The Silver Surfer is the fallen angel. And when Galactus relegated him to Earth, he stayed on Earth.
When I was at Marvel, Steve Ditko used to come up and sit in my office.
The quality of his art and the peculiarity of his art made Spider-Man the most popular costume hero in the field.
Today's flawed superheroes are superior in physical strength, but common, average, ordinary in mental strength. Saving the world, the universe, yet help us to solve their common personal problems. It is like creating a perfectly physical adult with the reasoning limits of a six-year-old.
When I first created Wolverine, I created him as a Canadian mutant, specifically so that whomever ended up with the assignment of writing the new X-Men book, should it ever occur, would have a Canadian mutant handy if he wanted him. I think from our perspective, what makes Wolverine so attractive is the unpredictability. The belief that he doesn't give a damn about anybody but himself and spends his whole life proving that's not true.
We thought that the Punisher would be a one-shot type of character.
But there was also the sense that he had more depth and more appeal beyond just being an antagonist. Well, I think it's his damaged soul, like Spider-Man, is surmounting tragedy.
I got a call out of the blue from two editors at Marvel Comics. We want to create a new, young, American Muslim superheroine and put her on her own monthly comic book series. Since there was a possibility that this series was going to be an epic flop, I felt I was at liberty to tell exactly the kind of story I wanted to tell. I wasn't interested in writing some kind of model minority book. Fanfic writing Pakistani American girl from Jersey City named Kamala Khan. When she wakes up one day with superpowers, the result of something called Terrigen Mist, which is an epigenetic terraforming gas created by a bunch of alien human hybrids called the Inhumans, she takes on the crime-fighting name Ms. Marvel.
The Marvel Handbook, the unofficial podcast of their universe. A legion of hosts take an encyclopedic look at Marvel's seminal directory of characters and concepts, available for audio streaming from most of the usual suspects, as well as on YouTube, brought to you by Rolled Spine Podcasts.
Now it's time for Speak of the Devil, which is our own version of the Blue Devil Letters column, which was originally called Circuits and Sorcery, where we are covering your feedback for the previous episodes. So remember, if you want to be involved, leave your comments on the Firewater Podcast website. That's where we'll be pulling our comments. We'll just be pulling bits and pieces of the comments you shared, and we're going to read them here on the air. Frank, you're up first.
Sean Ross is up first. He wrote, "Great episode, guys. You're right. Gil Kane is a legend, but an odd fit for Blue Devil. As for a fan casting for Bolt, I'd go with Jason Statham. He's a good utility action star who presents enough of a threat to be taken seriously, but is beatable. I miss the Jesse James trickster. The new kid is just annoying. I wouldn't mind him getting scourged." And yeah, I think so say we all. And yeah, Statham would be great, but he's out of the budget for my show. Like, my show is going to be like direct HBO Max, you know, digital streaming budget. And then he would have been too young to be in Shag's 1984, you know, theatrical motion picture. So he kind of doesn't fit in our realm. But yeah, obviously he'd be a great Bolt. I just don't think anybody could afford him to play Bolt.
I think he's almost a little too cool to be Bolt, because I always think of Bolt as kind of a schlub, like the not ready for prime time player is kind of how I visualize Bolt. But Jason Statham in anything would be amazing. So
he's admittedly a little silly looking, but he's not only is he treated as a formidable person in this comic book, but he goes on to be in Captain Atom, where he's a dangerous lethal dude too. So despite the goofy headgear, I can see it.
All right. They were from Bucky749, who says, "Let's see. I've fan casted Norm as Robin Williams," which is actually kind of clever. "And my trickster is Andy Kaufman." That's wild. And he says for Bolt, he would cast the pro wrestler Wild Bill Irwin. He has experience working under a mask, or in this case, a helmet, so he can use body language to convey emotion and can work to do different characters really well. If you've never heard the name, you actually have, just didn't realize it was him from an early WWF wrestling character called The Goon. Also, as a bonus for my Blue Devil is Tony Danza, a younger version from Taxi. He was a legit boxer, so with some extra training in Hollywood magic, I think he could pull off the Blue Devil. You know, Tony Danza would be an interesting Danny Cassidy. And that's not bad. Then Robert Gross followed up saying, "Wow, I thought I was the only one who remembered Wild Bill Irwin."
Mark Baker Wright chimes in. "Not going to lie, the moment I saw the mention of the classic car in perfect condition on the cover, I was expecting it to be trashed by the end of the issue. What a bait and switch. They only trashed a mere Porsche before the classic car even appeared. Thanks for the kind words." Well, Frank, at least. Shag knows what he said. "I look forward to future collaborations."
Yes, I do know what I said, Mark Baker wrong. then we heard from Doug Adamson, who says, fan cast Bolt, you say? Generic Merc who is called up whenever you need someone at short notice? Well, if it's the 1980s, I'd go with the generic wrestler from the WWF era. I have no idea who any of those are, I'll be honest. But these days, well, obviously you need a generic wrestler. Corey Rhodes, I guess. He's been in Arrow a few times as a generic metahuman villain. Seems Rhodes is a big name these days, so maybe not easy to cast, but a generic wrestler option remains. As for the issue in question, I sure miss Paris Cullen's pencils, but Gil Kane brings something different, and I don't mind him at all. The comedy of the issue still carries the book. However, it's a great story where things happen to a superhero rather than superhero looking for trouble. Those are always the best. And then he says, Marla is greater than Sharon. Not that we're worried about these things, but Bill Kane sure makes Marla look fantastic. Yeah, he really did. He made Marla Bloom stunning in that issue.
Well, and I'm going to pick Marla over Sharon every time, regardless of who's drawing her. Just way more my type.
Yeah, me too.
And yeah, it's one of those things where for the longest time, people kept bringing up John Cena and I wasn't a wrestling guy. So at one point I fan cast him as OMAC because he had a good jawline and I didn't know who this dude was. So I can't count any of these dudes out. If this Rhodes dude is making waves in wrestling, he's going to be in a Rock movie before too long. And I guess I'll have a sense of what this guy can accomplish.
Yep.
So Nate the Great writes, Gil Kane just was not a great fill-in for Blue Devil. Kevin Maguire or Joe Staten would have been a better fit. And I could definitely see Staten. I don't think Maguire was drawing yet at that time, so it'd been a little early for him. But obviously, I'd love to see McGuire do, you know, anybody.
Joe Staten. Now, not necessarily how he was drawing in 1985 wouldn't have been my choice, but the way Joe Staten was drawing, like in, you know, the late 70s, oh my gosh, he would have been amazing on Blue Devil. Oh, it would have been just top notch.
I mean, for a fill in, not sticking around, for a fill in, the way he was drawing when he was doing the crisis related issues of Green Lantern, I'd be cool with that.
Well, I mean, Joe Staten on the book regularly would have been gorgeous, but all right. So we heard from Dr. Ange, who says, fun episode and it sounds like a great issue. I agree with Frank that Gil Kane feels off brand, but what I have seen online looks like he did better than I would have thought. He says Richard Pryor doing Saturday morning cartoons makes me think he had a higher cocaine bill than even he could manage and needed cash any way he could. Muppet Babies, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, and D&D were all faves. Thought for sure I had a fan cast for the Trickster. I think Anthony Edwards in Gotcha, Sure Thing era. Goofy blonde hero, unlikely action hero, young and goofy. Yeah, actually, Anthony Edwards as a Trickster would have been pretty good back then. Yeah, I like that. As for Bold, I think a young Tim Robbins has the right look and feel. He could be subtly malevolent in feeling and thinking of the slick guy in The Player. Interesting. And really loving the deep dive and love the you and Frank banter. I don't know, there's so much called it banter as hatred. But anyway, Tim Robbins was not on my radar for Bolt. That is interesting. I have to think about that.
Was Tim Robbins active at that point? Or I guess it doesn't matter. It's a fan cast. So it could be today for all we know. Yeah. And yeah, I actually caught Gotcha around the time it came out, or at least when it was hitting cable. And if anything, that was probably the coolest looking Anthony Edwards ever was. He actually looked like he was, you know, a proper lead in a mid-80s, you know, spy thriller. Now, pretty much everything after that, yeah, kind of goofy. But in that movie, he had good hair.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's because he still had hair.
So John Stibe wrote, I really enjoyed this episode, Shag and Frank. To be honest, comics that are fun for fun's sakes are needed now more than ever. I was a fan of the Blue Devil series when it originally came out, but it's nice to be reminded how good it was. Shag, thanks for being this network's weirdest magnet and for waving that flag of joy proudly.
You know what? I'll take it. I'll take that title and run with it. Thank you, John. Then we heard from Tim Price, who says, I'm already missing Paris Cullins on the interior pages. When I think on it, Gil Kane was a good fit for Bolt somehow. His costume has an aesthetic that would fit right in with the Green Lantern story, so maybe that helped him get his assignment. Still, I'd much rather have someone whose style captured the fun of Blue Devil. And he says, I really appreciate the addition of James Jesse to the cast. He's not truly a reformed villain, so he can be unpredictable, as we'll see next issue. I'm trying to think of another villain that became a reoccurring supporting cast member in a comic book before this, but all I get are things like Hawkeye in the Avengers, which I would call a main character role, or Catwoman in Batman's comics as mostly love interest, which has a specific dynamic. James and Danny have a very specific frenemy dynamic, and I can't place anything else like it. Yeah, Tim, I think the closest we could get would be those sitcoms, like we talked about, like the Dan Fielding, and I know there's a million others that I'm just not thinking of right now, because I typically, when I watch a sitcom, I always like the irredeemable characters. So I think it's more the sitcom characters where this falls. And then Tim goes on to say, oh, one quick note about Pryor's Place. I never watched it, but it's the same formula as Bill Cosby hosting Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. Before that gig, Cosby's stand-up routine wasn't as family-friendly as it would become later, so going with Pryor isn't as crazy as it may sound. All right. That's, I think, the only person on Earth who's going to defend Pryor's Place. So thank you, Tim.
And riffing off Dr. Ange's comment, the algorithm has been feeding me Dick Cavett segments lately, and I just recently watched one with Richard Pryor around the time he put out the movie JoJo Dancer. And I think that he'd already had the incident that got him off the coke, and probably part of his, you know, 12-step program was doing a CBS children's show, because I think he was trying to be cold turkey at that point.
Or maybe had kids at that point, which tends to make stars want to do stuff for kids. Could be either way. All right. Well, it is time to move on to the casting couch. This is where we fan cast one of the characters from Blue Devil. Previously, we have covered Dan Cassidy, Marla Bloom, Wayne Tarrant, Sharon Scott, Neboros, Norm, and Trickster. And today we are going to fan cast Bolton. By the way, I just want to say, I loved the comments from this past episode, the ones we just finished reading. There was a lot of people jumping in on the fan casting, guys, and I love that. Thank you so much for contributing. This has been a segment that Frank had to drag me kicking and screaming into, but I have found that I've really enjoyed it. So, Frank, who's going first here on their Bolt pick?
I think I better go first, because nobody's going to know who the heck I've picked. Again, I'm the budget show. I'm the streaming show. I like Bolt, but I agree with a lot of people. He's not a name. You probably are never going to see this guy without his mask on. My priority was somebody who had an interesting looking face for the, you know, the 30% that's showing at any given time. So I'm really looking at noses, mouths, some cheekbones, chins, that kind of thing. And what I came up with was Emmon Farron, who's an Australian actor. He has been playing Kahir or Kahir. I don't watch the show, but he's on The Witcher. And he also played Richard Horne on Twin Peaks: The Return. He's sort of like the Kirkland signature Killian Murphy. So
that, wait, did you just make a Costco food reference for Cillian Murphy?
Yes, Killian. It's actually pronounced Killian. I know it really? How it's spelled.
Oh, wow. Okay.
One's Irish, one's Australian. But he definitely, Farron has a resting Patrick Bateman face. And so he's just one of these guys where if you've got to have a generic bad dude, he seems like a good guy. But also that sort of like his very distinctive nose, kind of a raptor nose, we'll say. It just feels like it looks right for a guy like Bolt. So now that we've gotten the guy that nobody's going to Google, nobody can even Google if they wanted to, because how do you spell that name without having it in front of you? Let's talk about somebody that somebody's actually heard of with Shag's pick.
Well, I did Google him, your guy, because I hadn't heard of him either. And he's definitely got a good look. I mean, I can totally see that face under the mask. I mean, he almost looks like a Keith Giffen drawing with his eyes, but that works.
Yeah, and he's a young whippersnapper. He's only in his early 40s now.
Oh, jeez.
Given how old everybody else I'm picking are in their 50s, just like, right. he's the kid of the group.
So if I was doing modern era, which obviously I'm not, but if I was, I would probably go with someone like John Bernthal, you know, the guy who played the Punisher, with his like broken nose and his bruiser attitude. That's how I think of Bolt, actually, is like a guy like that. But again, not doing modern era. So instead, obviously, I'm going to go with someone from the 1980s. And for the actor I picked, his name is Jonathan Banks. You may have heard of him, but I want you to think about his era in the 80s when he was in Beverly Hills Cop and when he was in the TV show Wise Guy. You know, you're probably wanting to think of him from Breaking Bad or Community or something. But in the 1980s, he had a mostly full head of hair, and he had a really rough face, looked like he'd been in a few fights, and he could really give you a menacing stare. So I think you put the mask on him, and also you have the scenes where the mask is off. I think he would make a great Bolt. That's my pick.
Yeah, Jonathan Banks is one of those that guys. And he had that golden period from like 82 or so until about 86, where he's like in 48 hours. He's the guy who gets killed when Nicholas Nolte has to give his gun up. He's in a Beverly Hills Cop. He's one of the guys who like killed his buddy and starts Axel Foley on the investigation. He's in Gremlins. And for me personally, he's in Armed and Dangerous. He's the guy who was the representative for the mobbed up union that Eugene Levy and John Candy are trying to join to become like security guards and stuff. So he was in a bunch of movies that I remember fondly from my youth. And yeah, he was such a perfect, just like thuggish, you know, intimidating guy. And on top of that, in that last one, he was partnered with John Bryan, who was, of course, always playing these kind of roles and was also in 48 Hours. And they're both cops in that one. They're both crooks in the other one. Totally can see it in that time period for sure.
Awesome. Well, cool. Frank actually liked one of my picks. That doesn't happen very often. So yay.
Well, it's also funny because John Bernthal, when he was just the guy from Walking Dead, I had fan cast him in a Martian Manhunter related thing, but he's way out of our price range now. The dude's the Punisher. He's going to be in a movie that makes $1 billion this weekend.
And he's in The Bear and a bunch of other stuff too. Yeah, you're right. Think about the movie that's going to make $1 billion. Gotcha. That took me a minute. We're recording this right before Spider-Man comes out, folks. So this is in your past. Anyway. So, folks, you know, we want to hear your thoughts. Who would you fan cast for Bull? Some of you already shared those ideas, which is great. So please share that in the comments. And now, Frank, if people want to get ahead of the game, who should they be thinking about for fan casting for the next episode where we cover Blue Devil?
So I actually have two challenges, one of which I thought of as we were recording. Number one, let's try to get Gopher cast since he's starting to have more and more of a presence in the show. He's was definitely present in this episode. He's going to be present in the next episode and get a bigger and bigger role. So Kid Devil slash Gopher for spoilers. And then the second challenge, let's say we did get the Avengers and the Justice League of America and it went off okay and we had the other projects they were going to do. Which Marvel hero do you want to see teamed up with Blue Devil in their intercompany crossover?
Ooh.
And what would you like the creative team to be if you'd like to go that far into it?
So it's got
to
be Marvel. So which Marvel hero or team do we want to see Blue Devil teamed up with, or, you know, versus or team up with? Whatever, and which creative team working on the book? Okay. Wow. Loving this idea.
And everybody's first pick was going to be Spider-Man. Try to use a little imagination, guys. Come on.
I mean, yeah, it was going to be Spider-Man. But okay. Yeah. All right. So there you go, folks. You have your homework assignments. It'll put it in the comments and they will be read on the next episode where Frank and I discuss these very two things, our fan casting for Gopher and which Marvel hero or team do we want to see teamed up with Blue Devil along with a creative team. No Spider-Man included.
I mean, you know, you can totally do the basicest version of the challenge, but I'm just saying we've already thought about that one. And yeah. He's already been in several of these crossovers with Superman. Do you really want to, you know, make Blue Devil look so bad that he's got to be like the third choice after Spidey's already done these much bigger, more famous DC heroes?
So with these rules you're putting down, are we saying they have to be heroes that were active in 1984 and creators that were active in 1984? Or giving people freedom to do what they want?
I mean, you know, I say, you know, like, so let's say that like Michael Chin had a great run on Blue Devil and he blew up and he still got a series today. I'm not going to, you know, restrict you. If you want to go nuts and do it part of this new series that they've been doing with big names, go for it.
Well, I just know, like, you know, someone said Blue Devil and Deadpool or something like that.
And of course, the next thing I was going to say is, and by the way, everybody's thinking of Deadpool. So yeah, we know, you know, you can try to go further out than that if you want to, but if you're just really committed, go for it.
I'm gonna have him team up with Maggot from the X-Men, because there's a team that everyone has been demanding to hear see.
Well, we're going with the X-Men, why not Angel?
Oh, Angel and Devil, that's clever, but you know, he'd probably be better with the Beast. So all right, so many options, folks. We want to hear your thoughts. Again, share it in the comments and we will read it when we cover it ourselves in the next episode. Now Frank, this has been awesome. I want to thank you for joining me as we celebrate Blue Devil. I cherish these episodes and our discussions. It's absolutely so much fun. And the episode's going to come out to be maybe an hour and 20 minutes, hour and 30 minutes. And folks, he and I have been talking now for 3.5 hours because we enjoy chatting so much. So Frank, why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you at home?
I continue to be on Rolled Spine Podcast to the degree that I managed to get podcasts out anymore because I'm still really slogging through the DC Secret Files, very deep dive research. I'm looking forward to it getting to the point where it's my own timeline. I think I'm going to have a lot easier time dealing with material that I lived through.
Like maybe the actual Secret Origins and Files comics themselves?
Sure, exactly. That kind of thing. but also, I'm trying to, once again, this is a broken record, but I am putting out new episodes of the Marvel Handbook, what was intended to be a companion show to Who's Who, which it never was remotely. So pathetic. comparison to the quality and quantity of Who's Who, but I'm trying to get that back out again. So if you're interested in hearing about Beast or Black Bolt or Black Cat, by the time you hear this, that'll be out there on the internet. So if you want to go check that out. And to riff on what you said, you know, this is one of my favorite things to record. I love spending this time with you. It's one of my favorites because of the subject matter, because of who I'm recording with, and of course, most importantly, because I don't have to edit it.
And we had a lot of flubs this time. I made my life miserable by screwing it up myself. So, all right, well.
Well, and there's that extra joy as I can picture you wincing every time either one of us screws up, because it's going to be your problem again, not mine.
Right. Well, editing is the burden of being a podcaster. Anyway, Frank, thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it. And folks, well, I love talking about Blue Devil. Next episode, we'll be tackling a different topic. But don't worry, we'll get back to the Blue Devil coverage in the coming months. What will the topic be next episode? Sorry, folks. You're just going to have to wait and find out. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Frank.
And remember, life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy.